Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jenna Blum, best-selling author of Those Who Save Us and Storm Chasers. Ms. Blum's remarks were given as part of the 11th Great Conversations Luncheon, presented annually by the College of St. Mary. Those Who Save Us is a story of passionate but doomed love, a vivid evocation of life during World War II, and a poignant mother-daughter drama. To summarize the novel, for 50 years, Anna Schlemmer has refused to talk about her life in Germany during the war. Anna's daughter Trudy was only 4 when she and Anna were liberated from Nazi Weimar by an American soldier and went with him to Minnesota. Trudy can't remember much, but she has one piece of evidence from the past, a family portrait showing Trudy, Anna, and a Nazi officer, the Obersturmführer of Buchenwald. Driven by the guilt of her heritage, Trudy, now a professor of German history, begins investigating the past and finally unearths the dramatic and heartbreaking truth of her mother's life. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, March 19, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Sister Mary Ann Stevens, President of the College of St. Mary.
Whenever we have an event here like Great Conversations, we always want to make sure that people know who we are here at College of St. Mary and that we're just not in any room, like in a hotel or whatever. And so the way we do that is always to invite a College of St. Mary student to speak to you about her experience here. Today, I would like to invite Erica Diaz to the podium to share her experience with you of how her education at this women's university has helped shape her life. Erica will be graduating this May with her bachelor's degree in elementary education. She was born in Mexico and moved to Norfolk, Nebraska at the age of 10 with her 2 siblings and her parents. Please help me welcome Erica.
Thank you, Sister Marianne. It is a great honor to be part of this great event, surrounded by exceptional women and men. And it really brings me great joy to be part of a university that not only pushes me to be a lifelong learner, but also where empowerment to women is highly encouraged and practiced. As Sister Marianne said, I'm currently studying to be an elementary teacher. I have come to find that this career has given me many experiences filled with joy and frustration. I have become tired and stressed, but overall, I have been the happiest while teaching and working with children. However, I did not always see this joy. After completing my associate's degree at a community college, I was faced with the question, where do I go next? I was faced with doubt, uncertainty, and financial issues. I was starting to lose hope. But I'm truly thankful to one person that always encouraged me and reminded me to never stop dreaming. That person is my mother. She has always been my support, my strong rock. It was her that helped me reunite with a high school friend that at the time was also attending College of St. Mary. And that is where this great journey began. It only took me one college visit to realize that this is where I needed to be. I came to College of St. Mary 4 years ago. I will forever be grateful for all those scholarships and grants I was awarded. My parents are very dedicated, strong workers. However, they would have never been able to pay for this great education I'm receiving. This university gave me hope when I needed it most. Not only am I about to receive my bachelor's in elementary education, but this college has given me opportunities to grow as a responsible and respectful leader. In these 4 years, I've been given the opportunity to be part of the Student Senate, the Campus Pulse Team. I've been able to be a resident assistant, and I'm the first multicultural assistant to the Office of Student Leaderships and Organizations. I do not say this to boast about myself, but it's a constant reminder that one can go far and be successful when given the opportunity. And College of St. Mary gave me that opportunity. Once I graduate, I know that my relationship with this university will not disappear. I'm happy to tell you that my sister will continue this journey as she is currently a first-year business student. All I have achieved has been possible with the help of many great women in my life. My goal as a future educator will not only be to help my students pass all those excruciating state tests, but to also encourage them and inspire them to believe in themselves and in the great things that they can accomplish. I want to be remembered as a tall, walking woman of inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you, Erica, for being with us today and for sharing a piece of your story. We are confident that you will go far and you will be an inspiring and tall walking woman. We are honored today to have Jenna Bloom, New York Times and internationally best-selling author of Those Who Save Us and The Storm Chasers. Jenna is also one of Oprah Winfrey's top 30 women writers. She has been writing since she was 4 years old, and professionally since she was 16, with her short story, The Legacy of Frank Finkelstein. Jenna is a graduate of Kenyon College and Boston University, and she has taught creative and communications writing for 15 years for Boston University and most recently for the Grub Street Writers. That's a story that she'll need to tell you. Jenna was a literary magazine's fiction editor for 5 years and now contributes the Friday 5-0 and Writer on the Road advice columns for the Grub Street Daily. Jenna is currently researching her third novel and has just finished writing the screenplay for Those Who Save Us. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Jenna Bloom. Jenna?
That was such a great reaction to the screenplay. Oh, that was fantastic. Thank you. You can all hear me okay? Okay, good. I love hearing myself introduced. Thank you, Sister Marianne, because I think, who is she talking about? I spent most of my time wearing yoga pants in a room playing with imaginary people. So when I get to come out and visit with real people, it's very exciting for me. And I really appreciate the invitation to be here. I'm so thankful that you imported me for great conversations. Thanks especially to Diane Prue. I hope I'm saying her name right, because she put up with all of my emails like, well, what time do I have to be there? Well, what time do I, what is to eat? Well, when are we eating? Tell me again what we're eating, you know? And I am really seriously quite grateful to be speaking for such a terrific institution. I went online and researched the College of St. Mary to spy, you know, to do my due diligence. And I called my boyfriend and I said, look at this amazing institution that empowers women, that has all these great courses for women, science and math courses, and the Marie Curie Award and scholarships for math and sciences for women. I mean, I can't do a math problem to save a hungry country, but I am a little bit of a science geek, and I always wish that I had been encouraged more when I was in school to pursue that. And so I think that is terrific. I mean, programs for single moms, which I think is so progressive. My boyfriend is the single son of a single mom. President Obama is the son of a single mom. You know, so single moms can do these amazing things for their kids, for themselves. I just feel really pleased to be speaking on behalf or speaking to such a female-powered community. And I mean no disrespect to the gentlemen who are here. Every once in a while, I do have a male reader write to me about my novel, Those Who Save Us, like two or three brave male readers. And once in a while, a man shows up at a book club, which is kind of a rare experience. And usually he comes in from the garage and says, oh, my God, the book club is still going on, and disappears again. But sometimes they stay and have read the book and ask questions like, what kind of staff car would this Nazi have driven? I'm not really sure that this would have been the right staff car for him, which is a sort of different question than the women ask. But I'm always grateful to have crossover readers, to have male readers. And yet I think of Those Who Save Us as primarily a women's book because it centers on these two very different but very strong in their own ways female narrators. And so it seems especially appropriate to me to be speaking about Those Who Save Us for the College of St. Mary. So I'll talk a little bit about the book. I just wanted to give a shout out before I do to the book clubs. How many of you are here are in a book club? Wow, that's a really good a good crowd. If you're not, it's okay. I'm not mad. It's fine. But the reason I have a special love for book clubs, I visited over 800 book clubs in the Boston area alone. That was where I was living when Those Who Save Us came out. And it started because I had a student whose mom was in a book club, and she invited me to come to her house to talk about my book. Those Who Save Us is a debut novel. That means nobody cares that you wrote this novel except your family and friends. It came out in hardcover, and I call it the Family and Friends Edition because that's who bought it, basically. A debut novel often has a very short shelf life, like Radicchio. I mean, it's there one day, it's gone the next day, and as the writer, it's like your baby has a month to be alive. It's really frightening. It's really, you know, sort of tremendously frantic making. And so I would have done anything to promote my book. I mean, I would have busked in the subway. I actually went around putting my business card under people's windshield wipers. I mean, I was out there. So when this lady asked me to join her book club, I thought, are you crazy? Of course I'm coming to your book club to talk about my baby for 3 hours and drink your wine and eat your cake. And I mean, just like, what a wonderful experience. And that was exactly what I did. I walked into a room, a stranger's home. There were lots of ladies sitting in a circle, and they all had my book, which made me a little bit weepy because, you know, I saw it outside the house, my own house, very exciting. And we sat around and we talked about it for 3 hours. And it was such a joy for me, who writes because I'm in love with my characters and my stories, but writes in total isolation with the desperate hope that someday, somewhere, somebody will pick up the book and come to know the characters and love them the same way I do. For me to sit and talk to people who also, by some miraculous telepathy called reading, knew my characters as well was just this great miracle to me. And when I left that book club, the hostess gave me an orchid, and although she since has passed, I still have it, and it still blooms. And I think about her every time it does bloom. And from then, the book club started passing Those Who Save Us around. And this was when the book was out in paperback, so it's second and last lease on life. And 3 years after it came out in paperback, my agent called me. My agent is French, and she always sounds like an evil Judith Kranz character anyway. And she hates it when I do her accent, but this is how she sounds. So she has this like special new voice for me. She called me up and she said, Jenna, Those Who Save Us is now onto the New York Times bestseller list. She said, all of my colleagues want to know, how did the book come onto the New York Times bestseller list 3 years after it came out in paperback? She was like, they are calling you Z-Biscuit. And so after I translated that into Z-Biscuit, I realized that my name had become synonymous in New York publishing circles with the horse who came from behind. But it was really a serious question she was asking, because editors and agents, everybody wanted to know, well, how did you do this magic trick? Because usually a book, you know, comes out, drops down the well, or comes out and is noticed by Oprah, is made into a movie, gets a lot of front table real estate because the bookseller pays for that. And so she was asking me a genuine question, and I said, my book, and there's no trick to it, it's because of readers in book clubs who took the novel and passed it around and gave it from mother to daughter to sister to reader to book club, which was why in 2008, when the book jumped on the list, I was speaking at 3 book clubs a day and to promote it and to really stomp for it and drinking a lot of espresso. So talking a lot faster than I am now, even. I mean, I would like talk really fast about the book and then drive off to another book club. But really, I am so grateful to my readers and to book clubs for keeping the book alive, like lofting it up into the air like a volleyball and keeping it there, because I think that's how a book should be kept alive. I don't think it should be a big industry thing. I think it should be a reader thing. I think if you love a book and you pay it forward, then you're doing the best thing for the book you possibly can. So a really huge special thank you to all the book clubs and everybody who's read it. How many of you have not read Those Who Save Us? Okay, so you have homework to do. And since I'm going to talk about the book for a little bit, it probably would be nice of me to tell you what it's about so that you're not totally lost. Those Who Save Us is a novel about a German non-Jewish woman named Anna who during World War II in Weimar, Germany, becomes a Nazi's mistress to protect herself and her little daughter when she's discovered in the act of the resistance. And then it's the other half of the book is about the daughter, Trudy, 50 years later. She's a German history professor in Minnesota, and she is trying to find out what the mom, Anna, did to keep them alive, because Anna will never talk about it. She's a difficult mother. How many of you have had difficult mothers? Okay, so this is what the book is about. And by the way, if you ask my mom what she thought about the book, she would just say, this book is all my doing, because if it weren't for me, Jenna never would have been born. So she takes sole responsibility for the novel and was very chagrined that I also shared the dedication with my dad. I pointed out to her, like, if he had also not been around, I would not have been born. But this is like a minor point to her. So this kind of tells you what I was working with for my subject material. Mother and daughter in the book are very estranged. My mom and I are very close. Actually, last week I was in Florida speaking for a large Jewish audience, and my mom came with me, and everybody likes to say, Mom, how do you feel about the book? And I'm like, Mom, tell them about when you were sleeping with a Nazi officer, you know? And she's like, because the book is totally not autobiographical. It's all fiction, you know? And usually she's in the back of the room putting cookies in her purse anyway, so I was like, you know, catching her when she's taking all the baked goods. She loves that. But, I mean, I have to shake it up a little because she comes with me to so many speaking engagements, and she knows the story behind the book. And I always ask her, aren't you tired of hearing me talk about this book? And she says, never. So that's really cool. I kind of wish she were here. It would be great. Anyway, people often ask me, how did you get the idea for this book, and how did it come to be written? And so I will address that question, even though it's really difficult to answer. I mean, writers know that where did you get your idea is a really tough thing to encapsulate in like a sentence, because a story maybe can be born from one idea, but a book is born out of a whole constellation of ideas and impulses and interests that you inherited. So I'm warning you now, you have mimosas, you can drink them, because this is not a terribly short answer. I was raised by a Jewish newsman, not religious, and by my mom, who's part German, part Norwegian, calls herself a recovering Lutheran, so was raised by agnostic parents. And I was born in this country. My parents were born in this country, so my parents' grandparents, my great-grandparents came to this country from all of their respective countries. In fact, my dad came to America from a country that was either in Poland or Russia, depending on the year, with the glorious name of Duckshits. Poland or Russia. And so people often think, okay, well, this must be where you got the idea for the book. You know, your dad was Jewish. That obviously is the thing. But actually, my parents, because they raised me in no religious tradition, what they did give to me was a sort of inherited interest in the time period. And I think it came from reading. We were talking about this a little bit last night. My parents are huge readers. My dad, as a broadcast journalist, had all of the scholarly tomes on his shelf, like Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and the Buchenwald Report and all the William Shire books about the war. And my mom had the sort of like Ken Follett, swastika emblazoned supermarket novels. And I was surrounded by this and by walls and walls and walls of books from my earliest memory. And when I was a little girl, I read, maybe about four, I read a book called When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, which is about the experiences of a German-Jewish refugee child who gets pushed out of Germany with her family by the Nazis and has to go from country to country. This upset me greatly. And I went to my parents and I said, I don't understand why the Nazis and the Gestapo were so mean to the Jews. And my parents finally figured out I was talking about the Nazis and the Gestapo, and after they had a laugh over that, and I still mispronounce stuff, they tried to explain to me, well, Jews are persecuted on account of their religion. But having not been raised in a religious household, this made no sense to me. It was like saying, well, Jews were persecuted because they wore purple pants. Like, what? And I think that was the first question that was planted in my mind like a fish hook. And I think often, to, you know, a regular person, there's a question, it gets answered, you make it get answered, or you let it go. But to a writer, when a question is planted, it becomes a genesis maybe for a book later. I grew up in New Jersey, with all sorts of hiding places in my house for when the Nazis came to get me, for when they, you know, marched up the driveway in 1975 or whatever. I had window seats that I could hide in. I had a sort of shelter with food in it. And that was from reading the Diary of Anne Frank. And I was later told when I speak at Jewish functions that a lot of the girls there had played the same game I did. And the difference, again, between me and normal people is that I didn't stop playing it until 30 years later when I wrote the novel. Really, the key in the ignition that sort of turned on my inherited interest and made it into this specific story that crystallized the interest was that my mom took me to Germany in 1993 when I was fresh out of college and knew everything because I was a recent college graduate, and she decided to show me I was wrong. And she wanted to see where her German side of the family had come from. I was really underwhelmed at the idea of going to Germany. I said to my mom that there were so many more pleasant places that we could visit, like Greece or Spain or Morocco or Canada or Arkansas or Newark or anywhere whose countrymen had not aided and abetted in the slaughter of 6 million Jews, some of them maybe on my dad's side of the family. But my mom being my mom, and now you know a little bit about what she was like, I shortly found myself in Germany with her. We drove around the country without speaking any German, and I still don't speak German, without any real plan. My mom had to drive because I don't drive a stick shift, and that was all that was available. So we also were drinking lots of little bottles of schnapps to combat our fear of dying on the Autobahn with my mom driving like 500 miles an hour. And everywhere we went, we visited where her family came from, which was a little farm town. It was a little wide place in the road, much like the town her people later emigrated to in Minnesota. And we asked each other the question, how could the Holocaust have happened here? What makes Germany different from America or England or any other country? What in this fairy tale looking environment, because it's a very beautiful country, could have contributed to this very mechanized, very precisely thought out mass slaughter? Why? And one day we went to concentration camp Buchenwald, which was the first camp that we visited, although not the last. And while we were in the camp, which is in the foothills of the Ettersberg Mountains, I realized you could look down and see the city of Weimar nearby. And Weimar was a county seat. It was the home of Goethe and Schiller, many great writers and thinkers, composers, artists. And I thought how cruel it was that the prisoners in the camp could have looked down and seen civilization so close and yet so far. And then I thought, well, what did the people of Weimar think about the camp, the Germans who lived in the city? How much did they know? How much did they permit themselves to know? Because we can all exercise terrific powers of denial when we're confronted with unpleasant truths. What did they tell each other? What did they tell their children when the ash from the crematorium was falling from the sky? Forgive me, I know it's lunchtime, but you know, this is what we were working with. And when we were driving down from the camp back to the city of Weimar, I said to my mom, if you had been born in Germany during the war, if you were a young woman, what would you have done? My mom was uncharacteristically quiet for a moment. And then she said, honestly, I don't know what I would have done. I like to think that I would have helped my Jewish neighbors by saving them, by feeding them, by hiding them, by helping them get out of the country. But if the Nazis caught you, they would kill you. It was not a hypothetical, and it was not a game. They would kill you, and they would also kill your children. And if I had you kids to care for, I don't know that I could have been brave enough. I could only hope that I would be brave enough. And that was the exact moment that the character of Anna, the mother in the novel, came to me. And I think of her as an ordinary German woman who's forced by this crucible of circumstance into what Holocaust scholars call the choiceless choice. And so from then on, it became only a matter of writing the book and researching the novel, which took about 10 years on and off. The actual writing took 3 years, but the researching took much longer. I read everything I could find about the Holocaust, so I have a really extensive Holocaust library with titles like, again, the Buchenwald Report, and most memorably, Who's Who in Nazi Germany, which terrified a lot of visitors to my apartment who didn't know that I was working on this book. I read every survivor memoir I could. I watched German movies. I listened to German music. I tried to steep myself as much as I could in the culture and the language to write the characters from inside out. And I also, for a brief period of insanity, one of my readers called this method research, which I thought was really kind of her, but it really was kind of insanity. While I was writing Anna's section of the book, the mom's section, I dressed like her. So every day after I was teaching at Boston University, I would come home and pay my bills and whatever, and then I had this German domestic costume where I like put my hair in little braids and I had a skirt and like dress and 1940s clothes. But I only did this in my own home. And I had a really good Halloween costume for like 3 years while I was writing the book. I was always a German domestic. But I really wanted my readers to know what it felt like to be Anna from the inside out, as I said. I also baked everything that appears in the novel, which was no small feat because half the novel's set in a bakery and I'm not a baker. And I also don't really have a sweet tooth. So my friends were like, would you please stop writing this book already because you're making us fat, giving us these rolls and the soccer tort and the German chocolate tort and the Kirsch tort and the whatever. But so I was baking and baking and baking. And the most important research I did, although I didn't do it for research for the book, I did it because it was a great privilege, was to interview survivors for the Steven Spielberg Survivors of the Shoah Project, which allowed interviewers like me to go into survivors' homes with video crews and film Jewish survivors' testimonies about what they had gone through in the camps or as hidden children, as partisans, living in Shanghai. I mean, I heard the most incredible stories. And people often ask me, did I use any of the stories I heard from survivors in Those Who Save Us? And my answer is an emphatic no, because the stories don't belong to me. They're hallowed ground. They should belong only to the survivors and to their families, subsequent generations. But interviewing survivors, which was such a great blessing for me and such a privilege to be part of, allowed me to create the emotional atmosphere for Those Who Save Us. Survivor guilt, which many of my characters suffer, survivor shame. Why did I make it through? A lot of survivors said, my sister Rachel was the pretty one, my cousin Meyer was the smart one, my parents were the good ones, I was just this scrappy little kid who liked to play with mice. Or, you know, just people really were beating themselves up about it 50 years later. Survivor silence. Many of my survivors had not talked about their experiences for 50 years until I came to their homes, not to their children, not to their grandchildren, often not to their spouses, even if the spouses were often survivors. Their past was something they had put in a box and locked away in order to proceed with their lives. So that really helped me understand that generation and people who've been victim of atrocities. And finally, a fierce kind of hope and pride at having made it through this most awful, fiery conflagration. At the end of every testimony, the survivor's family was allowed to come and be with them on camera, although they had been prevented from coming in the room before that, so survivors could tell their stories just to me. And everybody would cry. I mean, the families would cry, the videographers would cry, the videographer's assistant would cry, I would cry. The only one who wasn't crying usually was the survivor, who would be sitting there like, look what I made! I have great-grandchildren! Take that, Hitler! You know, so it was this really great moment, and that kind of fierce survival spirit was also something that I tried to encode into the novel. So on the other end of the spectrum of, you know, what made you want to write this book, I had a hard time approaching this book. I didn't think I had the moral right to write it because I'm not a survivor and have none in my family. But once I had interviewed survivors, I thought, if I can convey, albeit through a fictional lens, even a fraction of what these people went through, then I have an obligation to do that. And so I hope in writing Those Who Save Us, I paid survivors a homage. And believe it or not, that's the short answer to how did you come to write this novel. So thank you. And I'd be happy to take any questions, anything at all. I'm your pet writer. You can ask me anything. I mean, people have asked me before, like, is that your real hair? To how long have you been writing? To whatever. And if I don't know the answer, I make it up, because that's what fiction writers do. So please feel free to ask me anything you like.
A member of the audience asked Ms. Blum to talk about support from other writers and readers from social media, such as Facebook and other new technologies.
Thank you for mentioning my Facebook page, not just because now I don't have to do it, but you should all friend me on Facebook. But I do try and sort of take readers with me wherever I go, and I have this fabulous experience of traveling around the country to speak at different events, and I love that. I love meeting readers, and I love going to book clubs, and I storm chase in the summer, and I have a really cool dog, and, you know, so I try and post as much, you know, once a day so that people can come with me, because I feel very privileged to do this. But Facebook actually is a large part, I think, of what writers do now. We were talking about this a little bit last night with some colleagues from the college about how social media is a big part of how writers can promote themselves, because in the olden days, like when Those Who Save Us first came out, publishers were still sending their authors on physical tours. So when your book came out, it would most likely come out in hardcover. You would go to bookstores to promote it. Two people would show up, like your mom and a homeless person, unless it was a town where you had lots of friends, and then your friends would show up and your mom and the homeless person. And then once in a while, you would get a really good crowd. And so I think eventually publishers, when they started to sort of hemorrhage money because so much is shifting over to digital publishing, and digital books cost less, therefore you get paid less, therefore there's less money to promote and to send writers on big fancy planes and whatever. We are increasingly turning, I think, to the digital realm to promote our work. I have to admit, as the writer, I feel that I have very little influence or understanding of what goes on in publishing, in a sense, because it's a business. And as a writer, I think of myself as a professional creative, but not necessarily a professional business person. So people often say to me, like, how many copies of your book sold? I don't know. Well, how can you not know? Are you dumb? I'm like, no, it's just I'm a control freak. Novelists are often control freaks. We like to make our little detailed worlds exactly the way we like them. And to send that out into the world and not have very much control over how many copies you sell, to me, is a very painful thing. So I don't check the numbers. I get quarterly reports, you know, but I get a fabulous resource for writers every day called Publisher's Lunch, which is a free subscription you can sign up for on the internet, and then it will send you news from the publishing industry, so I know what editors are where, what agents are representing who, what books are being published, and for how much. So I look at that. But mostly, I feel as though I have a sort of grassroots understanding of how the industry is changing. And really, it's changing from us being sponsored by our publishers to go out into the world and speak, and more doing it ourselves. So a lot of times, especially when I was promoting Those Who Save Us, I would fly to a place out of my own pocket, because I think, what is more important than promoting this book? I wrote it because I love it. Nobody's going to love it as much as me. I am its stage mother. I will fly to Washington and talk about it, whatever. I do a lot of driving. I drove here from Wichita. You know, if you ask me, I will come. There I will be in my car. So I do a lot of grassroots in-person stuff. And I think that if you are a professional writer, you have to have a website. You must have a website. And there are very easy, inexpensive ways to do that these days, where you just get on, you know, a Mac and they give you a template and you put up photos and quotes. Voila. That's your calling card. And then being on social media like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. I know people are on Pinterest and Shutterfly, Instagram. I don't do all of those. And I advise writers to pick what they're good at. And then kind of stick with that, whatever you feel comfortable with. I am a social media addict. Hi, I'm Jenna, and I'm a social media addict. So I'm comfortable going on Facebook and posting a photo and a post every day. I'm on Twitter all the time. I keep friends in my pocket that way. I love that. I support other writers. Sometimes your publisher will say, well, do a blog. Readers love to read what you're thinking about. I hate blogs. So there are any number of ways for writers to keep themselves in the public eye without doing something that feels onerous. I think the biggest change is that we must do that for ourselves now. And the control freak in me really digs that. I like it. Thank you. Short, again, short answer. Yes. Okay.
The Minnesota connection.
Look, it's like Oprah. You get your own mic, so you should definitely ask questions.
So you said that your mother's relatives immigrated to Minnesota, and that's how that came to be into the story? Okay. The second question is, when the war was over and the United States Army was freeing in Weimar, they were not always nice to the German people. In your research, did you speak with Army officers and what was happening at that time?
Those are great questions. Thank you. And I will sort of answer them backwards and go with the second one first. I did not speak with any liberators, camp liberators, although that was a later part of the Shoah project, actually. After interviewers finished interviewing survivors themselves, whether they were homosexual, Catholic, Jewish, anybody who had been persecuted by the Nazis, they also interviewed liberators of the camps because it was a really important historical component to putting this big piece together. And I should back up a little bit and say the Shoah Project was started as an answer to revisionists, which I think is far too kind a word for people who say the Holocaust never happened. So now we have this whole mass of information from eyewitnesses saying, yes, actually it did happen. It happened to me, my family, my dad was a soldier. He saw this. So they also interviewed liberators. I did not, because I was in grad school by that point and not interviewing as many survivors as before. But in my research that I did, my book research, there were accounts of German civilians being forced into the camps to tour the camps, as it were, to see what their countrymen had wrought, so that nobody could claim, oh, we didn't know what was happening. I lived in Munich. Dachau was, 15 kilometers away, but we just thought they were making bread there. Like, no, So the soldiers became so enraged, the liberating soldiers, by German denial that they forced Germans to go through the camps, women, children, old men, whoever was left over. And I imagine that it wasn't a particularly pleasant experience for anybody. In some cases, the Germans were made to bury the dead, which I talked about a little bit in Those Who Save Us, although I never permitted myself and my imagination to go into the camps because it's not my territory. So anything you read about in the novel is my extrapolation from research I did trying to understand what it might have felt like from the point of view of an American soldier or a German civilian put in this excruciating and grotesque situation. And the other question was the Minnesota connection. My mom was born in Minnesota and my grandma was born in Minnesota in a tiny little town in southeast Minnesota called Caledonia, which I have nicknamed New Heidelberg in both my novels. So the town itself is a sort of continuing character in the novels and will actually be my third novel too. I kind of like that idea of the town. The town goes on. One of my favorite reader reviews ever, 95% of the reviews are good, and the 5% that aren't good are the ones that you remember for some reason. But one of them was, Blum has clearly never lived in Minnesota because she got all her details wrong. And it was one of the few times I actually allowed myself to take myself out of the stocks that you voluntarily place yourself in as a writer. Throw things at me, I wrote a book. And I wrote back to that reader and said, you are so wrong, because I'm really proud to be, part Minnesotan. I own a house in Caledonia, and it's called Blue House because it's blue. And so when you see me posting from Blue House, that's where I am. And I really enjoy the Minnesota connection. My mom's people were all farmers, and they loved to garden. And, I can do a pretty good accent when I feel like it. So I was like, well, Missy, you sure are wrong. You shouldn't be taking pot shots about Minnesota then, should you? No. So that happened, and I never heard from her again. Yes? That's a great question. My Nebraska connection, my sort of Great Plains, the question was, what is your connection to Nebraska? It's a storm chasing connection. When I was researching storm chasers, which I'll give you my Reader's Digest condensed version of that too, it's about boy-girl twins. The boy is bipolar, and his sister's not bipolar. And when the boy is manic, he likes to chase storms. And when and his sister kind of chases him and tries to keep him safe and tries to keep him from doing more damage to himself and to her life and to other people's lives. And it's really about mental illness and people's trying to put their arms around it and come to terms with it and prevent it from being damaging, which is really sort of impossible. But the book does have a storm chasing context to it. And I chased storms for 8 years with a storm chase tour company called Tempest Tours. Out of Arlington, Texas, which takes people up close and personal to big weather without getting them killed. And I have been a storm fanatic since I was a little girl in Caledonia in Minnesota. I saw a tornado at night when I was 4 years old and everybody else in my family was asleep. I watched it move across my grandmother's picture window from right to left, a rope tornado like in The Wizard of Oz. And whereas a normal person would have thought, go to the basement, I just thought, I'm in the movie. So... And I was really, I loved The Wizard of Oz as a child. I was really mad at my mom for not naming me Dorothy. And yeah, I'm still, well, no, I'm not mad anymore. It's okay. But yeah, I really, really loved the movie, and I envisioned myself as the heroine. So writing The Storm Chasers was in a way getting to live that out and at the same time pay attention to bipolar disorder, which is a really important topic for me. So I followed this white van of geeky science weather guys around for 8 summers. I now work for the company. I've started running tours for them. My partner, who's a severe weather photographer, is running a photo tour for the company. We have been to every crevice in Tornado Alley in every state, and often in Kansas, often in Nebraska. I know these states better than Massachusetts, where I'm nominally from now. And so the references to the Sand Hills region, which I think is so beautiful, and to Kearney and to the Great River Road Archway Monument, which is like one of my pet things, you know, it's like so great. Those are all put into the book because I love them. I just think it's so great. And part of the joy for me in writing Storm Chasers was to introduce readers who wouldn't normally get to these very remote places to a landscape that to me is... like Ansel Adams, except in color. I mean, just extraordinary. So I felt really grateful to have been able to do the research I did for that book.
Thank you. You got into character, like you dressed up like the character, a lot like method acting. It's like method writing. Would you suggest that to someone?
So the question, would I suggest my method research to other writers? I kind of dug it. I don't know. I think for me, being a writer is a way of living out several different lives that I didn't actually get to live within one life. So doing the research by going storm chasing and looking at big weather, which I'd been interested in since I was little, or, you know, practicing what it would be like to be a German domestic and doing all this baking. These aren't things that normally I would be allowed to do. But I was able to do it in the name of research, write it off as you know, my taxes as research, you know, which is really great. Although I must say I did get audited and the IRS was like, why did you have to go storm chasing 6 years in a row? And what is that? So yeah, that happened. But I mean, I don't know. I really think it's about how you function as a writer. I write in a very tactile way. I like to bring the worlds in my books alive for my readers, not just visually, but in terms of what the characters hear, smell, literally feel, sense and taste. And so for me, doing this sort of method research is really invaluable. For writing historical fiction, it's kind of a trick because you can't go back into a time machine and feel what it was like in 1945 to be Rosie the Riveter or, you know, working in a German bakery. So you sort of extrapolate as much as you can from your print and online sources. And then anything you can do to sort of plug in a tactile way, I think, helps bring a book alive. But if you don't want to partake in this totally voluntary craziness, I don't think it's going to make you a bad writer. Just don't forget the 5 senses in your work. I know she's a writer, so I can get away with proselytizing a little bit. Mm-hmm. What's my next book about? I actually have a book 2.5 that's coming out this summer in July. It's called Grand Central, and it's an anthology of post-World War II novellas by female best-selling World War II authors. So me and Melanie Benjamin, who wrote The Aviator's Wife, Sarah McCoy, who wrote The Baker's Daughter, Christina McMorris, who wrote Bridge of Leaves, and so on and so on. We all got pulled into this project to contribute novellas that were all set in Grand Central Station on the same day in September 1945, when people are just coming back from the war. And I was so reluctant to do this project because I had already spent 10 years sort of in the research trenches for Those Who Save Us, and I thought, I just can't go through this again. Like, I've left that time period. I don't want to go back. And my agent said, do it. So I did. And I surprised myself by falling totally in love with my character. I mean, I despise writing on a deadline anyway, and I had a deadline. I was, nah, you know, being a whiny little beep writer. I don't want to do this. I don't feel inspired. And once I got into the story, I am so in love with my character and what happens to him, a man who's trying to figure out how to rebuild his life from the wreckage and trying to figure out whether he even deserves to do that because of what he's been through in the war and what he's done and what he hasn't done. And our characters in our novellas populate each other's novellas. So we did a sort of, you know, 6 degrees of separation thing where if you read one novella, you see a different character from a different novella from another point of view. And the book calls against Grand Central and it comes out from Penguin in July, like right before July 4th weekend. And it will launch in Grand Central Station at an independent bookstore there, and all the authors are going to be there, and we all get to wear period costumes. So more method research. But I get to, now I'm like addicted to ModCloth, this website that sells all this period clothing. And, you know, every day I spend an inordinate amount of time on there thinking, well, I could wear that to the launch. Well, look at that hat. Spectator pumps. I can wear that. So, and the third book is currently under construction. And I just sent a synopsis to my agent 2 weeks ago as requested and haven't heard back, which is a little ominous. But it's historical, again, in scope, and it will either, it's a kind of go big or go home novel, I think, because it spans several decades, and it feels very ambitious to me, so I'm a little bit scared of it, but I also think about it all the time. And to people in my immediate life who are cursed with hearing me talk about the book, I'm like a girl with a new boyfriend, like a teenager with a new boyfriend, because I'm like, oh my God, guess what this character said today? I had the greatest idea. And it's like total non sequiturs all the time. It's probably like living with a very high functioning autistic. Like, oh my God, did you actually see the Watergate hearings? Because I was just watching something about Watergate and I just saw Nixon say, blah, blah, you know, I mean, just out of nowhere, like we're at the supermarket. So I'm very excited to get back into that book, to get to a steady, quiet place where I can explore it and see where it takes me. Is my boyfriend an author as well? We met on Facebook, actually. Everybody assumes my boyfriend is an extreme, his name is Jim Reed, and he is an extremely renowned and award-winning weather photographer, extreme weather and landscape photographer. And I had been following his career for 2 decades, because I loved his work so much. And when I was researching Storm Chasers, I saw he was on Facebook and I friended him and kind of stalked him. And his work is really extraordinary, and I don't even think I'm biased in saying that, because I'm a really harsh judge of other people's creative work, because I'm a harsh judge of my own work, or at least an exacting judge. Really beautiful photos. And one day he wrote to me on Facebook after I'd made several extremely witty comments on his photos and said, you know, my publisher wants me to do another book and I want to talk to you about doing print versus online publishing. You know, what do you think about that? Can we have a phone conversation? I was like, oh, must we? I hate talking on the phone. I hate the phone. I never talk on the phone. But I loved his photo so much, I said, fine, I'll talk on the phone with you. Let's talk on Friday for an hour. And we talked. We never talked about publishing. We never talked about, you know, writing. So we set up another Friday chat, and soon we were having regular Friday fireside chats. And then lo and behold, I was living in Wichita. So that happened. And we're both moving to Boston in August, because I miss my writing community, and Jim is ready to show some of his work in galleries. But the two of us often joke about making a reality show out of our lives, which we think are so interesting, or, you know, a documentary about two creative people sometimes battling for supremacy, because it is like having sort of, you know, Mozart and Beethoven walking around in the same house talking in total non sequiturs about what they're working on. Like when Jim is working, he comes up from his studio in the basement reeking of cigars with hair standing up like this, you know, and he'll come into the room and I'll go, because I have something in my head and he can't talk to me. I'm like, don't talk to me, I have a character. And he just goes, okay, and goes back downstairs. Like, this is our life. So I'm like, isn't that fascinating? Maybe a very short documentary or like a one. But it really, I mean, it is a real joy and a real, it's an interesting thing to live with another creative professional, because we joke about both of us being divas, because we both are. I mean, the man is a diva, okay? Don't tell him I said that, but he is a diva, like drama king. And I also am like a drama king. So when we first got together, we said, well, how are we going to make this work? We're both used to being, you know, in the center of attention. We're both divas. And I said, well, maybe we just have to learn to harmonize a little bit. And so that's kind of what we try to do. So that was a great question. Thank you. He's like, oh, my ears are burning. What is going on? Is she talking about me? Thank you so much for your awesome questions and for listening to me and being such a terrific audience. And I'm just delighted being here. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jenna Blum, best-selling author of Those Who Save Us and Storm Chasers. Ms. Blum's remarks were given as part of the 11th Great Conversations Luncheon, presented annually by the College of St. Mary. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, March 19, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Brittany Long, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.